All right, first of all, I'd like to thank all of you for being around here, your troopers. We're going to get started here. I won't be able to entertain you, but hopefully I'll make this painless yet informative. So we're going to get started here, and I think Dr. Abraham's talk was a nice segue into my talk. I'll be talking about rapid HIV testing. And the big to-do, if you will, about rapid testing is, and she sort of touched on it, is that you get your results back very quickly. Right now, the FDA has approved about 6 different rapid HIV tests. Some of them you can get as quick as within 5 minutes. The test that we use was a test that came out of OraSure technology, and you can get your results back in 20 minutes. Now, traditionally, with the test before, the traditional test, you would get the test, and you'd have to wait 2 weeks. And as mentioned by Dr. Abraham, you would have to then wait for a confirmatory test that could take upwards to 2 weeks. What happened during that interim? A lot of people never showed up. And the CDC has estimated that about 25%, in fact, of individuals never showed up, so they never knew their status. So if they came up positive, they wouldn't know. Consequently, there's really no change in their sexual behavior or high-risk behavior. Let's move forward. I have a number of slides to go through. Sort of rapid testing is going to be a little rapid fire here, but I still want to make sure that my comments are heard by you. Just in the way of an overview, some epidemiology slides at the very beginning from our sister federal agency, CDC. I'll present some of those. Then I'll get into the actual rapid HIV testing initiative, and then I'll give you some of the results from the second phase of our initiative, which I think you'll find interesting. This slide here is really to remind me of a couple of things. This is sort of our roadmap, if you will. I know it's a very busy slide, and I'm not going to belabor this slide, but this is what we call the SAMHSA matrix. For those of you who are not familiar with SAMHSA, it's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration. We're composed of 3 centers: the Center for Mental Health Services, the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, and the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention. I come to you from the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment. But this indeed was an initiative that was carried out in a collaborative way between all 3 centers. Even though I come to you from treatment, a lot of the individuals, too many names really to mention, I would probably miss some names, were a part of this initiative. You can see here as one of the priorities I've highlighted HIV/AIDS and hepatitis. I'm going to focus on HIV/AIDS, but you really can't talk about that without talking about hepatitis, as mentioned earlier, because of the possibility of infection with hepatitis C. We actually have another program within SAMHSA who's dealing with hepatitis C. In fact, they are distributing Twinix, which is a vaccination for hepatitis A and B. There's no vaccination for hepatitis C at this point. So let's get into some of the slides, which will kind of put us on the same page when it comes to why do we have this initiative to begin with. And really, to put it just point blank, what we wanted to do was focus on high-risk populations. And the CDC points out, and I'll share with you in the next couple of slides, is the people who are most at risk, besides your injection drug users and other individuals who are using drugs, are individuals of minority status. As you can see here, what I'm doing here is comparing, what CDC did here was compare the population. Here, if you look at the population for African Americans or black non-Hispanics, although they only make up 13% if you look at the right pie graph of the general population, United States, they were making up 49% of individuals who have AIDS. Also, when it came, and you can compare that really with the white non-Hispanic population, who make up 67% of the population, but only when it comes to AIDS cases, makes up 30%. So you can see the discrepancy, the disparity right there. And when we break things out according to male and female, and these are the results. If you could focus really on your far right, I think it is most revealing because you're talking about the rate cases per 100,000 of a specific population. So when we look at black non-Hispanics, we see 119.1 per 100,000. And you compare that, and we're looking at males here, you compare that to whites, you see about a 20-fold increase. And then even with Hispanics, you see an increase of about three times, 50.9 versus 16.7. Now, things get even more alarming when you turn to females, when you talk about female African Americans. You can see for black females, non-Hispanic, at 56.2 per 100,000, and you compare that to white non-Hispanics. Again, you're talking about a 20-fold increase here. And Hispanics, from 15.1 to 2.9, you're talking about a 5-fold increase. So you can see the disparity there as well. And if we obviously are focusing on individuals, not just minority status, but also individuals who have a history of drug abuse. And this particular slide focuses on injection drug use. And if you look here, you can see the disparity as well. Blacks, two times the rate at 53% versus 26% for whites. And then, so interesting enough, when you look at Hispanics and at face value, you would say, well, 19% versus 26%. But then you have to go back to that original slide I showed you as far as the number of individuals who are Hispanic. If you look at the actual cases and compare it to the number of individuals who are Hispanic within the population, they still represent a disproportionate number of individuals who have AIDS as compared to white non-Hispanics. And I think this last epidemiology slide tells really a big part of the story here. And this has been the change in HIV, AIDS, over time. Beginning back in 1985, it really was recognized. You remember the disease really was kind of known as the white male gay disease. Things have obviously changed. If you look around 1994, looking at this slide, you can see the change where beginning in 1985, it's about 60% of the cases were white, non-Hispanic, and that has decreased. But conversely, things that have increased, at least the populations have increased, were black non-Hispanics and Hispanics slowly increased. Although there may be some type of plateau there, the ending numbers, when you look at 2006, for blacks, it's about 44%. And then if you look at Hispanics, it's rising to about 18% of the population. So you can see kind of what's known as kind of the changing face of HIV/AIDS. Now, some of the goals of our initiative were really to provide rapid HIV testing to build the capacity, enhance the capacity for not only our SAMHSA grantees, which we fund throughout the United States, but our non-SAMHSA grantees as well. Again, we wanted to focus on high-risk populations, minority populations, other high-risk populations, and I'll get into specifically what those target groups were. But we also wanted to have the opportunity to retest individuals who were at high risk that had previously tested negative. Now, if you look at this slide here, you can see specifically the targeted populations I'm referring to. More often than not, what we're finding is that, you know, mental health and substance abuse go hand in hand, and hence the co-occurring population. So we're focusing on that group. Of course, we're focusing also on injection drug users, other high-risk populations being MSM population, men having sex with men, individuals who are exchanging sex for drugs and money. Also putting themselves at risk, and at-risk pregnant women. Of course, you cannot leave out the reentry populations. So we're trying to break that vicious cycle of people going into jail, possibly putting themselves at risk either voluntarily or involuntarily, and then come back into the community, and then putting others at risk for infection with HIV/AIDS. So let's get into kind of our framework for our rapid testing at SAMHSA. And let me say here, this is really kind of a different undertaking for SAMHSA, and it involved a pretty steep learning curve. Now, I know this slide is pretty busy, but the point I want to drive home here is that we learned very early on, we wish we had even learned even earlier, that we needed to get on board with each individual state, because there were different rules and regulations with each state when it came to rapid testing, what they would and would not accept when it came to training, what they would and would not accept when it came to how the test was being conducted. So it was important that we talk to the single state agency and also Departments of Health representative that was dealing with HIV and substance abuse within a particular state. And we sort of had to get their buy-in. I mean, not all states were interested. Interesting enough, a lot of times I think it was an issue of manpower or woman power in order to carry out the initiative. But once we had the buy-in and we got somebody on board who could act as a rapid HIV testing coordinator, then I was able to work with them along with other people within SAMHSA to get the ball rolling. And we would assist them with technical assistance when it came to program development and also when it came to any problems with data collection, which is obviously very important for us to be accountable to our funders, to Congress and so forth. And then once we worked with this rapid HIV testing coordinator, then they would work with the individual organizations within the state, and then they would begin to place their order when they were ready. Now, there were readiness requirements. And again, we had to be in compliance with state readiness requirements. Linkages to care were very important to us. So if someone did come up positive, there was a proper referral in place to follow up with that individual from a medical perspective. Also, a quality assurance plan was essential, as you might expect, because you don't want to have a lot of false positives come up or false negatives come up with this particular test. Because of the possible ramifications from that. And as I'm known for saying, that with the rapid test, the great thing is you get the results back quickly. The bad thing is you get the results back quickly. And if we have time, we can elaborate that at the end of this session, as my time is running short here. I'm going to move right into some of the results from the Rapid HIV Testing Initiative, the second phase. As you see here, we had about almost 33,000 forms returned to us, and I'll show you a copy of the form that collected the data that was important to us. You can see here the number of states that were represented, number of providers, and this is actually a copy of the data form, site characteristics, different demographics of the individual, and the individual's reason for taking the test, and some of the risk behaviors involved, and the screening test results, and type of referral service, and finally, the confirmatory test. Again, this is a screening test, but it has a very high sensitivity and specificity rate, i.e., if you come up positive, the chances are you are positive. If you come up negative, chances are very high that you are being negative. Some of the site characteristics, as you might expect because of insurance limitations, a number of people came from outreach setting at 33.6%, you can see in the slide here, and outpatient setting, very few from residential setting. Some of the other areas were non-traditional settings, which was very important for us, AIDS service organizations, CBOs, your community-based organizations, and criminal justice settings and churches and so forth. Now, we talk about the demographics. Again, as you might expect, from 18 to 44 were really the age group that we found most of the people being tested, coming in for testing. There were some outliers as 55 and above, and I'm surprised a fairly high percentage of 5% of individuals below the age of 18. Again, we wanted to focus on minority status, but of course we weren't going to refuse anybody from coming in for testing. We were a bit surprised, however, with the high percentage of white non-Hispanics coming in for testing at almost 36%, but about 60% of individuals were of minority status. Now to get to the actual test results, interestingly enough, a lot of people who had come in for testing had previously tested, almost 64%, in fact, as you see the number 63.7. Interesting enough, those people, if you look at the very bottom part of the slide, the results that were negative was the almost 19,000, about 93%. But there are people who were positive before, but they were still being retested. And perhaps we can have some brief conversation about why were people coming in to being tested again if they'd already tested as positive. You may have your thoughts about that. Now, the reasons for a test are very important to us. Why were people coming in to begin with? And again, this is self-report, so we're depending on individuals to let us know why they were coming in. They were able to answer more than one particular reason. You can see here we're very interested in STD or sexually transmitted disease related at 21%. Also a recommendation from a drug prevention or treatment program at 5.4 and 2.2%. And then interestingly enough, towards the very bottom, individuals who were symptomatic for HIV/AIDS, a very low percentage were actually coming in because of that. Of course, what behaviors do you engage in that put you at risk? Another question that was asked, and just focusing on the top part of the graph, we wanted to know as it relate to alcohol and other drugs. You can see here a lot of individuals within the last 30 days had used alcohol to some extent, almost 30%. Some individuals admitted also to having sex while under the influence of alcohol. Other individuals that used other illegal drugs at 20% and had sex while under the influence of illegal drugs. And injection drugs is in there as well at 4.6%. Now, we get to the actual testing results. As you might expect, and nationwide, it's right around 1%. And actually, we expected to have a higher incidence of positive rates. You see here at 1.1%. But I think that goes back to that particular slide I showed you where we had about 60% of minority status, but we expected a higher percentage of minorities. And given that we didn't, maybe these numbers are a little skewed because of that. There were some missing data, some invalid test results. But interestingly enough, I want you to focus on the lower half of the slide, the number 207, because even though this test was required only 20 minutes to get the results, some people slipped away. For whatever reason, they slipped away, didn't want to see the test results, changed their mind, had a change of heart. But what happened to those individuals? Interesting enough, of that 207, 183 of those, fortunately, were negative. But there were 10 individuals who came up positive. So the question is, what happened to those individuals? Did they already know their status? Were they coming in because of some incentive, a free dinner or whatever, to come in for testing? a lot of speculation there as to what happened to those individuals. But of course, when you look at that number 10, that's a possibility of individuals going back out into community and possibly infecting others. When it came to referral services, really couldn't depend on this data because our the people who were doing the testing, there were different interpretations as to what we meant by referral services. When it comes to confirmatory tests, remember I said this is a screening test. We expect the sensitivity to be very high. But if you look at the numbers here, the number of people who actually came back for the test was fairly high at 77.7%. It's always difficult for people to come back and then to follow up on those individuals. There were different types of confirmatory tests that were done, blood, oral, and urine. Interesting about OraSure, and I don't have any connection with OraSure or anything, but they are the only FDA approved testing that allow oral sampling. Okay, that's a big distinction with OraSure. There are other pharmaceuticals that are working on that now, and I'm sure that'll be on the market before you know it. Confirmatory test results, there was a positive rate of 67%. We expected that to be much higher. So there's some reason for concern there because you didn't worry about the quality assurance part of testing. And then I'm going to end with just some things that we learned. Because again, as I said at the very beginning of the presentation, we were on a steep learning curve, and I think a lot of people who participated in the initiative were on a learning curve as well. So the good, bad, and the ugly. The good was, there are a number of things. People really appreciated, I think, the Rapid HIV Testing Initiative because we provided shipping. We shipped the kits free of charge. Not only the test kits were free, but the controls that went along with the kits were free. In fact, there were some organizations that said that they saved quite a bit of money. You see here in the slide, one organization said it estimated saving about $53,000. They didn't have to rely on their own on the other funds to get the testing done. The bad, of course, is some people, you know, may have had good hearts, but they overestimated what they could do. Some people were simply not aware of the expiration date, and that presented a problem because those kits have a certain amount of shelf life. For our test kits, they recently moved it up to 6 months, but before it was like 3 months shelf life. So that was a bad situation. Then the unpredictable really could not be predicted. I mean, because of weather conditions, there may have been some big event where they were going to do testing, may have been outside. Because of weather conditions, they couldn't have that big event. So a lot of tests went by the wayside. And then there were organizational changes that occurred, you know, where people who were qualified to do the testing were no longer at the agency, and they moved to a different agency for whatever reason. But those are some of the things that we learned along the way. We're not currently doing the distribution of the rapid HIV test kits, but we are providing training for individuals in the field. That really, I think, brings me to the end. I'm at 0 minutes, so I'll take a seat. Thank you for your attention.
Well, I think we should give a hand to our whole panel. It was a great presentation overall. And now it's time for question and answers. We have about just a little bit under 15 minutes. And so do we have questions directed to any particular of the panelists? You'll need to come up here to use the microphone for recording purposes so that they can capture it. And I might need to restate your question, too. Any questions from the audience?
Let me try to tackle that one. Yeah. I mean, that's a very good question. If I can try to restate what you were asking with regards to the individuals who had tested positive originally, do we have any other information as regarding, I'm not getting it correctly. Okay, so for individuals who had tested negative in the past and then were coming up to be retested again, if we look at any intervals. No. I mean, we were really limited as to what information we could collect. The form that I showed you was really all the information that we could collect, and it was quite an ordeal even getting that information. You have to go through, if you start getting more elaborate, you have to go through the Office of Management and Budget, and that can take 6 months or to a year, unfortunately. What we wanted to know about, obviously, was individuals who came up positive or negative, and those people who were retesting, what were their reasons for retesting? Now, you may speculate, and I think I have speculated, individuals who come up positive, perhaps they were retesting because their behaviors were the same. They continued the same behavior, but they were hoping, you know, that maybe their first test was not accurate. Obviously, the people I think who were coming up negative and then coming back, perhaps they were still engaging in high-risk sexual behavior. They hadn't changed their behavior, even though they were negative before. They're kind of using this as a barometer as to, am I now positive? And then sometimes you have to be concerned, too, of the window period. If you come up negative, there is a certain window period where you may actually be positive, but your body hasn't built up enough antibodies to be detected by the test. And that's what the test is detecting, is the number of antibodies to the virus.
Can I ask you my next question? Sorry. I'm assuming the answer is no, but I'm going to ask it anyway. For those patients that were found to be positive that didn't stay for the result, did you have any information about activities of that type of behavior and emotional
risks? Unfortunately not, no. The only thing that we wanted to make sure is that those individuals who did come up positive, that they were indeed referred for medical intervention, and so they would have, so they just wouldn't be dropped by the wayside, you know. So that was very important as a readiness requirement for the people who participated in the initiative, that, you know, if someone does come in positive, who do you have to refer to them that's reliable and can follow up with that individual? Thank you.
Any other questions? In the front?
Yes. We're editing a book that's going to be published next summer on HIV and substance abuse in the Caribbean. So if anybody has any research that's related to that that's in this audience or participants or whatever, presenters, you can email me at my email address, which is lnorman@dsm.edu. My name is Lisa Norman of Ponce School of Medicine. And we're accepting abstracts for that. So if anybody's interested in getting this work out, and it's going to be published next summer.
Okay, thank you. Another question? Yes?
So in terms of the dose, I'm going to actually ask Todd to 16 milligrams. I mean, it varied between all the sites, but I guess 16. I'm not a clinician, so. And in terms of heroin versus opioid pain meds, we haven't looked at that exactly so far yet, but it seems very to work across the board. I mean, there wasn't a lot of difference, but we need to look at that more closely, both in the quantitative data and in the qualitative data, which we plan to do. But we have much more heroin users rather than opioid users in the sample, unfortunately.
Yes.
Yeah, for the same too, your population. What was the racial and ethnic distribution of the population? Number one. What was the use history? Were you talking about a relatively new use group, or were you talking about a group that has been using for some time?
For the larger multi-site evaluation, it's an older group in terms of age. It's much more African-American, and it's long-term users for the most part. It's also long-term HIV positive group too. These are kind of the old guard, to be honest, in terms of the multi-site evaluation. I think Todd's is maybe a little different.
So what, is it fair to say then that an attitude toward opioid treatment may have reflected their experience? And experience could be fairly involve multiple providers. I don't know how many opioid providers you have in Oregon, but is that in part of the bias that I got from the slides relative to opioid treatment? I mean, relative to methamphetamine, if you mentioned.
Yes, the interview guides really probed life experience with treatment. So particularly the negative comments about methadone maintenance really referred to whatever treatment programs they had been exposed prior to ever entering the study. They weren't directed at our participating opioid treatment center.
But in terms of the cross-site evaluation, too, I mean, it's a very treatment-experienced population. There were very, very few people who this was their first time in any kind of treatment for opioid addiction. So it's like a new thing, right? It's like, wow, let's try this. It's exciting.
In the back?
I mean, really overwhelmingly, it was extremely positive. There's one person that I didn't include in my sample who tried to go on a bup, and she had tried half of a pill and felt like it made her crazy and speedy, and never actually finished her induction into the treatment program. So the people that I talked about were all folks who had been engaged in treatment for at least some period of time. So the one person we talked to, only one person, said that it made her feel speedy and she preferred methadone. We also talked to a bunch of people who just were methadone and didn't try buprenorphine, and a lot of them were like, you know what, methadone's great, I love it, it works for me, and that's I don't want to mess with that. Don't mess with success. But for the 32 people that I talked to, all were like, this is great. They weren't all still engaged in treatment. Some had relapsed, some had decided to stop, some had, but even the folks who relapsed talked about this as like, oh yeah, I'm going to go back soon. I'm just taking a little, you know, drug holiday. So yeah, surprisingly, it was unanimous.
Yes?
Yeah, just because you brought it up about counting pills, did you deal with the issue around diversion? It sounds like you didn't count pills to see if anybody was diverting. I just wondered whether that was across all sites or whether that was an issue.
Across sites, doctors were concerned about diversion. Some concerned, some not concerned. I mean, it's a very safe drug. People aren't going to OD with it on the street. We had a lot of people talk about having previously induced themselves by themselves on the street, so it's out there. We also had a lot of people say, there's not a chance I'm going to give my bup away. It's you know, I go home and I hide it so that no one can find it because I need it and I want to keep using it. But we did have people, of course, you know, I gave it to my partner. My partner was having a hard time coming down. I wanted to help them. So there was a little bit of that. But for the most part, people were really like, no, this is my meds and I want it. But again, they did have induction experiences outside the medical infrastructure. And I think, is that makes sense of what you think?
Yeah, we observed a similar findings. It didn't come up so much in our qualitative interviews, but our experience since then suggests that there's more on the street and that people are sharing it mainly out of altruistic sort of, gee, help my buddy sort of thing, get through a rough withdrawal. Buprenorphine is an incredibly safe drug to use relative to other replacement therapies. And I'll just be provocative here. And say, does it matter that diversion is happening?
In the back?
Uh, In terms of the quantitative data, that's what that's one of the things we're going to look at, is in terms of some sites definitely did kind of a bup arm and a methadone arm. In terms of the qualitative data, we did five methadone interviews, but I haven't done any kind of comparison because it was so much more skewed towards people liking the buprenorphine and just being very over kind of the methadone and treatment, and again that's because of their experience and having tried many times with methadone, but the kind of comparison piece I'd like to look at more, and we can to a little extent, but the sample of methadone users is much smaller for the qualitative study.
I actually like to ask one question of a different panelist so we can maybe get some other dialogue going for Dr. Abraham. When you had the, we're talking about the on-site testing and that the support groups weren't offered on-site, were you able to look at the reasons why they weren't offered on-site?
We didn't
ask. Okay. Oh, because I actually think, I run a drug treatment center and I come from working in the HIV world, and HIV is like 5 times stigmatized in the drug treatment center. It's a freestanding outpatient methadone clinic. And I've asked that question because I can't believe there's not any HIV support groups, minimal HIV testing being done, although it is done. And the answer I got to a person was that no one would come. It was too stigmatized. They didn't want to be seen coming into an HIV-specific support group, even if they weren't positive, to learn more. And I intend to work on that, but I just wondered if that had been asked, and it would be nice to know how universal that is.
If I could just comment on that, I mean, something like that, you know, because we're dealing with stigma, substance abuse, we're dealing with HIV/AIDS, and if you're talking about a focus group, you really have to, in all honesty, disguise what that focus group is in order to get people to become involved and engaged in that. And people have done some very innovative things to try to get people into focus group by that, by naming it something different. You know, and then those people who know about it know where to go and where to come. It's like coming to a van, if a mobile van comes to the community and it's plastered with HIV testing, you know, you're probably not going to get a lot of people coming on board. So people, if it's a general health promotion, healthcare van, the likelihood of getting people on and then get tested is a lot better. So we need to be, you know, more innovative in our program.
Thank you. We have time for one more question, and then hopefully maybe our panelists could hang around for a few minutes before you go to the ATOD social hour. So I saw one more hand up.
Oh, I was just going to answer your question and say I don't think it does matter who is interested in the same town. We're seeing a lot of buprenorphine changing hands. My main concern is the potential risk for overdose when people relapse. So from a harm reduction perspective on the fly, we kind of started here up. Coaching people because they are acquiring it and are coming to syringe exchange, and we have an escalation of opioid overdoses. So I'm trying to figure out how do we bring it out there, which I know is a little ways off.
Well, actually, I think maybe another study would be nice to know if, I operate a private but publicly funded methadone clinic, and I can only do so because the state gives me the money on a fee-for-service basis to provide methadone-specific. To offer for another population where buprenorphine might be suitable for the reasons you mentioned, you know, how am I going to purchase it is my problem. So I know the studies are out there, but the availability, and it's even higher price than methadone is. So, pardon? Well, maybe the question I would then have is, are the states looking at offering that in addition to methadone in terms of the fee-for-service programs that they have? And some of that, large part of that funding is SAMHSA sourced. So I don't know if there's an answer there somewhere.
I mean, SAMHSA regulates the methadone programs when it comes to that. It's a whole different matter as far as actually doing it, they regulate.
No, but I'm from Illinois, our state, the good portion of the funding we get for... Right, but it comes from, there's a portion of it, a good portion of it is federally sourced to the states to disperse.
That's from the state block grant.
Yeah, from the block grant. Any other comment?
I have a comment.
have a question. It's a statement comment, really. We all know that the parity legislation was signed into law. Now, in light of this discussion, what are the implications down the road a year from now when health plans, Medicaid programs, and others, including the states, have to consider how I maintain consistency with the parity statutory authority and continue to provide the services I have in the past? I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion that we have in the next year.
Okay, anyone? That might be rhetorical at this point. I don't know. Just any other comment on that? I think we're out of time and appreciate everyone's patience. Thank you for coming.